Ladies and gentlemen, good evening and thank you for coming. From now until the end of my life, everything that I make, from the lectures, the films, the tapes, and hopefully very soon the printed word, will be dedicated to building a treatment center for alcoholics in North Carolina. I live, as perhaps some of you know, with a family down in Maryland. And this rehab center is to be built on the farm on which the mother of that family was born, along with her 10 brothers and sisters. The 30 acres belonged to her dad, who was a Baptist minister. And the name of my center will be called Ashley, the family name, in honor of her parents, and in gratitude for 7 of the 10 alcoholic children who recovered. Ladies and gentlemen, this is probably one of the happiest nights of my life. I will tell you why, and I am thrilled and happy that you are here to share it with me. I keep telling May that I'm the lucky one. I keep getting on airplanes and meeting people like you, and she does all the heavy work at home, the scheduling and the sale of the films and so on. Very rarely has she been able to be with me on any of these tours. 8 years ago, come the summer, you may find this hard to believe, I was suffering a horrible fit of depression. And that, along with medication, nearly killed me. And I called the home of Tommy and May Abraham, the family with whom I now make my home, almost desperate. And Tommy and May invited me there, and through that summer, helped me to get well. It was from there on in that the good things began to happen to me. I remember saying one beautiful summer afternoon when I did not want to leave a darkened room, I was sobbing about as hard as I could sob, and May and her son Alex were sitting on either side of the bed. And I said this, I'm 45 years old and all I have to show for it is that damn blackboard talk. And May said, please get well, Father, and one day you'll be giving it around the world. And it happened. Because 2 years after that, the Navy filmed that talk. And through it, many of you have seen it. Tonight, my family is with me. The whole family. Their son, Alex, with whom I grew up. You see, I am the man who came to dinner. I arrived there 8 years ago, and I've been there ever since. Alex is here with his red hair like I used to have about 612 years ago. His fiancée, Gina. And with me for the first time are Tommy and May. Ladies and gentlemen, if any of you in this room has felt that anything I have ever said or done has helped you to get well and to appreciate the magnificent gift of sobriety, I want you to meet and love and thank the people who made me possible, Tommy and May. To get serious for a minute, we flew up here with a family friend, Charlie Oliver, in his lovely modern twin-engine Comanche. I practically live in airplanes. Last Wednesday afternoon, I was on a TWA flying east and saw myself on an Eastern flying west. I have an appointment to go to the toilet tomorrow afternoon at 4. But this is a marvelous little story. It concerns itself with an old Scotchman who was about 90 in the shade. And he and his wife, this was in the 30s, they wanted to take a ride in an airplane before they died. So it was possible. And I remember this. For $5, you could go to a local airport and take a ride around your city in one of these open cockpit bi-wing planes. So the old man went to the local airport. They looked up a young pilot. And the old fellow said, "We'd like to take a ride in your airplane." And the pilot said, "Fine, it'll be $5 for an hour." "Oh," he says, "we didn't intend to pay." Well, he said, "What do you mean you didn't intend to pay?" He said, "It costs money to run that thing." They began an argument that lasted about an hour. The pilot is giving birth to an Excedrin headache. And finally he said, "Shut up, I'll take you." But he said, "Give me a break. If you get scared and yell, you pay half." So they agreed. So he stuffed the old couple in the rear cockpit. He climbed up front. And he figured as soon as he revved up the engine, they'd die. Nothing. He got airborne. He figured if they looked over the side, they would pass out. Nothing. Now it's a game. He's going to make them yell. So he did a few barrel rolls and a few loop-de-loops and a few figure eights and nines and tens. The first hour is used up. The $5 is gone. It's no longer a game. It's a challenge. He's going to make them yell. He flew under a bridge, scared himself half to death. Did a power dive, nearly ruined the airplane. Finally, after 2.5 hours, he's out of gas. He had to bring it down. So he hopped out of the airplane. He was sore at himself. And he was just mumbling. Jeepers, he says, not even a peep out of him. And with that, the old man jumped out behind him and said, "Not," he said. "But I damn near yelled when the old lady fell out," he said. Now, that story has absolutely nothing to do with anything. I just figured I'd tell you. But I'd like to tell you a story now that does have a point to it. The Chalk Talk was filmed by a couple of Navy fellas in a small conference room in the Federal Building in Washington, D.C. We were taking part in an alcoholism seminar for about 50 civil service people. And I opened up by saying that we human beings have an absolute genius for making mistakes. Most of us are quite good at it. Some mistakes are funny. But all mistakes we make are usually the result of ignorance. It isn't what we know, it's what we don't know that causes the error in judgment. And as I said, some are funny, and we've all made them. The classic story they tell is about a little nun going to confession. On her way in, she tripped and fell. But it was so dark, priest didn't know it was a nun. That was the missing fact. And his error resulted. All he heard was someone had fallen. So he said, "What's wrong out there?" And the voice came back and said, "Excuse me, Father, I'm so nervous." He said, "Why?" She said, "My children." She taught the second grade. They were killing her. He said, "How many children do you have?" She said, 38. He said, "Get out of here. I thought you were drunk when you fell in." That's not the story. Some mistakes are embarrassing, and boy, have we made them. And some mistakes are very painful. And this tale has to do with a mistake that was all three. It seems that one afternoon, a very old and dignified Oriental gentleman became quite angry and irate over the fact that somebody had thrown his outhouse over the hill. He had two children, both boys. One was 8, one was 9. They were typical kids, mischievous, normal little boys. And he called them in, and he asked them point blank, "You know who threw Papa-san outhouse over hill?" And they didn't know. So he sat them down right in front of them. And he said, "Would like to tell you a story of an American boy named George Washington, who one day chopped down Papa-san Washington cherry tree. Papa-san Washington called him in, asked him if he know about cherry tree, and George said, 'Papa-san, no can tell right. It was I who chopped down your cherry tree.' Papa-san Washington pat him on head, give him cookie for to tell the truth."
The 9-year-old, big grin, jumped up.
Papa-san, it was I who threw your outhouse over hill,
and the old man nearly killed him.
When that little kid came to, he asked the obvious.
Papa-san, for why you tell story of virtue get reward? George Washington tell truth get cookie. I tell truth, you whip me.
And the old man told him why.
There's only one difference. When George Washington chopped down Papa San Washington cherry tree, Papa San Washington not in cherry tree.
The big difference.
Actually,
we never, 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 never make such a mistake about alcoholics. Such mistakes are always tragic. They're never funny, they're never just embarrassing, and they are never just painful. Tonight, I would like to discuss an aspect of our disease that is just kind of beginning to come into its own. From the beginning, true AA people, beginning with Bill Wilson and his wife Lois, stated that alcoholism is a family disease. But only recently have we begun to treat whole families. I know some AA people who are so narrow-minded, they don't want anyone interfering with their meetings to come in to give them knowledge that might help them caused by their illness. But I think that era, thanks be to God, is passing. I would like, if I may, this evening to discuss alcoholism as it affects other family members than the alcoholic. In the past 2 or 3 years, I was reading in an issue of Newsweek in the medicine section that they were adding family therapy to individual therapy. For example, a person suffers some aspect of mental illness, and he goes to a hospital for treatment. They bring his family in because of emotional attachment to help them understand him and to help him get well. They're not getting away from one-on-one therapy. If you have a specific problem, you need therapy for it. They're simply bringing the family in. So, for example, if any of you were to go home tonight to learn that your 13-year-old daughter has been raped, that's your problem. If you were to receive a long-distance call from home that your mother has terminal cancer, that's your problem. In the family of the alcoholic, this is not only true, but there is an added dimension. The people who live with an alcoholic become affected by his illness, and they in turn become as sick or sicker, emotionally, at least, than the alcoholic. My thesis tonight is a very simple one. Whole families get sick. The conclusion is obvious. The whole family has to get well. The whole family has to get well. Now let's go way, way back and begin at the beginning. In the musical South Pacific, the nurse, Nellie Forbush, went with a contingent of Navy personnel to an island in the South Pacific. There, she met and fell in love with a French plantation owner. They planned to be married until she discovered that he had 3 little brown children of a previous marriage to a native girl who was now dead, and she backed off. And someone sang a song to her, "You have to be taught to hate." And somewhere along the line, she had learned her prejudice pretty well. I would now like to turn that coin over. You also have to be taught to love. Even though we are made to love, we still have to learn. How many of us, when we were kids, heard our parents say constantly, give some to your little brother, give some to your little sister, share this with your friend, let your buddy ride your bicycle, etc., etc., etc.? How many of you parents constantly say this to your children to teach them to be giving, loving people? All right. We have to be taught to hate. We also have to be taught to love. Where are these lessons learned? Ladies and gentlemen, believers in free love notwithstanding, the family is still the basic unit of human society, and it is within the family confines that we learn everything. I can remember not too many years ago, my brother-in-law, who was a doctor, now deceased, was saying to me, I was a seminarian at the time, he said, many psychiatrists and psychologists, scientific people in general, honestly believe, as do I, that human character is basically formed before you enter kindergarten. He's right. We learn everything from our parents from the moment we're born. From the moment of birth, parental influence begins. And we learn to hate, we learn to love, we learn everything. Now, what is love? It's a thing like gratitude. Everybody knows what it is inside, or we think we do. But how do you spell it out? How do you define it? Have you ever been asked by somebody, what is love? There are all kinds of definitions, all kinds. We sing songs about it. We say, I love you, thousands of times in our lives. What does it mean? I'd like to share this with you. It came my way a couple of years ago. There's a young woman in our neighborhood, related. I love her very dearly. In many ways, she is a very, very beautiful, beautiful lady. Emotionally, when she is good, she is very, very... She has a temper that would blow this roof off. I'd like to fill you in on her background so you would understand this woman, where she comes from, and so forth. She is the daughter of alcoholic parents, both her mother and her dad. Her father is dead, and even in the drinking years, the mother would never allow a harsh word or a harsh thought about her husband. She took all the blame. This girl is involved in a kind of a happy-unhappy marriage. I personally believe that she married to get away. I believe a lot of people do that. She predicates her unhappiness of her mother. I am miserable, I am unhappy, I am unfortunate, I am the martyr because of my background and my girlhood. I didn't have a mother. My mother didn't pay too much attention to me. My mother was always drunk. I was raised in foster homes. My aunt had to raise me. If she looked on the positive side of things, she would have seen what she got from the raising she got. But in her mind, her unhappiness comes from others. She also believes that one day her happiness will come from others. Listen to these words. Maybe you've said it yourself one day or another. My day will come. My day will come. Happiness will be brought to her. Her unhappiness came from others. Her happiness will come from others. She hasn't the foggiest concept that we determine our own happiness. Can persons, places, circumstances, events, and things affect my happiness? Of course. If I were walking down the street and someone I loved were to slap me, I would cry. But what I would subsequently do with that depends on me. Perhaps from Dr. Ellis you have heard the classical example of happiness and so forth. He says it rains. One man's happy, one man is sad. The happy man is the farmer who has been waiting for it. The sad man is the fellow who wanted to play golf and can't. Ladies and gentlemen, the rain is the same. The rain didn't cause happiness or unhappiness. It was the individual's attitude toward the rain that made him happy or sad. I have met about 15 prisoners of war who spent years of their lives in the infamous Hanoi Hilton in North Vietnam. Some men came back and adapted and are back at their military posts. Other men couldn't cope. They couldn't cope with prison and they can't cope with freedom. I think a year and a half ago, a POW killed himself in Bedford, Massachusetts. They were all in prison. They all experienced imprisonment. But what went on inside determined what type of men they ultimately became. All right. Now, I mention all this by way of background because I think it's absolutely essential to everything I'm going to say tonight. This girl came over to the house one night to see me. She had just had a magnificent Donnybrook with her beloved husband. When all of the venom was out of the way, it took about 20 minutes, I said, you just mentioned love about 6 times. What do you mean by love? And she was a little bit embarrassed. I said, wait, hold on a minute. I don't have a definition in mind that if you give it, you're correct. If you don't give it, you're wrong. I just want to know what you think in your own heart love is all about. So she thought for a pretty good while, because she had never been asked this question before. And she said, well, Father, I'll tell you what. I'd like to tell you what I think it is not. I said, okay. She said, it is not what I thought it was when I was 16. You know, all the chemistry and the shortness of breath. These stupid novels, I cannot get through a novel. I really can't. Usually it's some clown with a message or some jerk who just can't write. But you know, all of these impossible feats of derring do that lovers perform in novels are written by pure fantasists. You know, she could hear the surf pounding in her ears. I suppose if you're near an ocean, you know. It was all brought to a head in a play written by a man who became a multimillionaire as a result of writing the play. It's called The 7-Year Itch, and his name is George Axelrod. You know how popular and accurate that play is? It was written years ago. It played 3 weeks ago out in Seattle. The 7-Year Itch is about the phenomenon of emotional love kind of dying out, and then you come to the nitty-gritty of two people trying to live together in a marriage. And it has to do with a couple who come down to breakfast and kind of half glance at each other, and each one of them is thinking, who is that? Who is this total stranger I'm married to? Where have all the flowers gone? But anyway, she went on and on. She said, it isn't all of that. I said, well, okay, what is it? What do you think love is all about? And again, she thought for a long while. She said, I'll tell you what, Flower. I truly believe that real love does not express itself in great big things. It expresses itself in little teeny-weeny everyday things. I said, like what? Well, she said, I'd like to be taken to a movie every 6 or 7 years. I'd like a box of candy for no reason at all, except that he wants to give me a box of candy. You know, it's not my birthday. It's not Mother's Day. Ladies and gentlemen, have you ever noticed that we Americans, who invented Mother's Day, have the very strange practice of American husbands giving their American wives Mommy's Day presents? And the wives accept them. Well, you just think about that for a while. She said, I would truly like to have him, as he's walking past, touch me on the head, saying nothing and wanting nothing more. And then she mentioned a whole lot of little teeny-weeny things that I refer to as the natural virtues. Kindness. Do you ever notice in many homes, once the family enters the door and the door is closed, the words please and thank you do not exist in their vocabulary? She said, I'd like to be thanked for a meal that I have really worked at for him. She said, every now and then I'd like to have a door held open for me, especially when I'm walking behind him carrying the groceries. And she went on and on and on. And when she finished, I couldn't do anything except point out the obvious. I said, you just gave a perfect definition. Perfect. Perfect definition of being loved. She named everything she wanted to get. And her unhappiness consisted in the fact that one other human being was not conforming to her idea of what he ought to be. God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, other people. I said, now I'll tell you what I think love is. To love is to give. I don't mean indiscriminate giving, ladies and gentlemen. Many people give in order to buy affection. I don't mean that at all. Giving that functions for the well-being of another, that is love. And I don't know where this absolutely insane philosophy of do your own thing came into being. Good God, if I did my own thing, I'd wind up in jail, so would most of you. And you even hear this in some AA circles, do what makes you feel good. My friends, love is doing somebody else's thing. Love is a young mother gagging while she washes dirty diapers. That's love. To love is to give. But you see, to give is to hurt because it demands sacrifice. Ladies and gentlemen, only big people can love. Only big people can love. Most of us believe that love is what we feel. Love is what we do. Love is what we do. To be free, this modern term, you know, people that run around twanging guitars singing about freedom. Freedom demands self-discipline, absolute self-discipline. Because in order to be free, to love you and to function for your well-being, I have to be free of selfishness. I have to be free of those things that shackle me to me so that I am free to love you. Somebody pointed out in a magazine article the other day, said it's amazing to watch these bearded, shaggy, ill-dressed folk singers get up on a stage and speak about the simple life, trudging along railroad tracks, but they're singing through $5,000 worth of equipment. Anyways, what has all of this to do with alcoholism and the alcoholic and his family? Ladies and gentlemen, it has everything to do with it. Please remember what we said in the beginning. You learn to love from your mother and dad. Watch what happens in an alcoholic family. What is an alcoholic? There are all kinds of definitions, and they're all good, they're all accurate, they're all correct. One whose drinking is characterized by loss of control. He thinks he handles it, but it handles him. And it results in problems, personal, social, or economic. It's a beautiful, good, and accurate definition. Doc Green used to say, a positive cellular craving for the drug without which you cannot function comfortably. Accurate and correct. One whose drinking causes problems is an alcoholic. Accurate and correct. Now I'll tell you what I think an alcoholic is. An alcoholic is a creature who has been lopped off from the very purpose for which it was made. The result is obvious. Total, complete, and utter misery. Frustration. Complete aloneness that results tragically very often in suicide. See those chairs you're sitting on? That's why we made them, to be sat on. Airplanes were made to be flown. A chair is a chair when it's folded up in a closet, but it is most a chair when you're sitting on it. That's why we built it. An airplane is an airplane when it's in a hangar being repaired, but an airplane is most an airplane when it's in the air. That's why we built it. What are we? What is the human being? Why was the human being made? My friends, we are love machines. We were made to love. We were made to give. We were made to be committed to others. In fact, no one can achieve happiness alone. It cannot be done without others. Bill Wilson asked the question that held the key to all of human functioning, and it was his question, the answer to which he found, that explains why this room is full. He said, I wonder if I might not get sober by trying to help another drunk. One's personal sense of identity, fulfillment, and happiness is intimately bound up with commitment to other people. Commitment to others is love. We were made to love. What's that got to do with the alcoholic? He can't love.
The practicing alcoholic is enslaved to a chemical. He is biochemically addicted to a drug that shackles him to himself. He's not free to function for another. For those of you who have ever had difficulty with step one, our lives have become unmanageable. My God, an inanimate object controlled almost every waking thought. This chemical determined the people that you associated with and those you stayed away from, the restaurants you went into and those you stayed away from. Your life was manageable. Alcohol controls the alcoholic. He is not free. That's why he dips into and takes pennies from his little kid's piggy bank instead of putting them in. Every function of his is geared toward obtaining and using the drug without which he cannot function normally. His love expresses itself in sick, sentimental, almost prostituted, upside-down ways. He can't love. My own personal definition of the alcoholic, it's nothing more than an analogy, but it's a good one. An alcoholic is a fish out of water. Did you ever watch a fish die? Catch a fish and throw it on the ground. We human beings breathe oxygen through our lungs from the air. A fish breathes oxygen through its gills from the water. Take a fish out of water, throw it on the ground. Fish can't scream, you know, but their bodies, needing oxygen to survive, twist and writhe and flip and flop, screaming in silence for the very oxygen they need to live by, and they can't get it, so they ultimately die. That's the closest thing to the alcoholic I can come to. We're screaming to be able to give, and the chemical binds us to self. How does it manifest itself? My gosh, ladies and gentlemen, it's obvious. What is the noblest and greatest expression of giving love? Sex? A man and wife are man and wife when he's in San Francisco and she's in New York. A man and wife are man and wife when he's at work and she's at home. When are a man and wife most man and wife? When is a chair most a chair? When it is fulfilling its purpose. When are man and wife most man and wife? When they are one. In body and soul, in the greatest, noblest act of giving known. Sex. That is what the contract of marriage is about. A priest, a minister, a rabbi does not marry people. You marry yourselves. It's a contract in which a man and woman stand before each other and the world. The clergyman is the witness. And they say, before the world, I give to you exclusive and total rights to myself. It is the supreme act of giving because it is so complete. I give you my entire self. In an alcoholic marriage, sex is a total act of getting. The spouse becomes a chunk of meat to satisfy oneself on. And so you find an almost perverse fulfillment of the contract. In many an alcoholic marriage, there is no sex. Alcohol being a sedative drug, it knocks it right out. Or if in the beginning, and I had a wife say this to me just a week and a half ago. She said, maybe there is none toward the end, but in the beginning, sometimes it's a nightly circus performance and you have to go to bed with a drunken pig. How many years do you put up with that before it becomes repulsive? When that act in which two people should be one becomes something that you wish to God you could forget. And then with the inhibitions killed by the drug comes the infidelity, the adultery, and everything else. And the absolute breakdown of the relationship. How could you? The contract says you belong to me. And then, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to mention something that is very rarely spoken of in public, incest. My friends, not only is this phenomenon there, it is far more prevalent than you will ever know. Or maybe you do know. I did the film of this talk last July, and just before we left, I mentioned to our young lawyer that I was going to mention incest in the film. He said, Father, you wouldn't believe how prevalent it is. I said, what do you mean, Hal? He said, within the past month, I was involved in 3 court cases of incest. In one case, the man was a psychopath. He was just crazy. In the other 2 cases, alcohol. Listen to this, ladies and gentlemen, please. It's important. In my home state of Maryland, we have 23 counties. This was one county.
There are 12 months in the year. This was 1 month. These were three cases that came to court. Multiply that by 50 states, you may have a slight inkling as to the prevalence of this disease. Coming up in the airplane tonight, May said, did you read in yesterday's paper the incident of a 13-year-old boy who last month shot and killed his father because the father had involved him in a compulsory homosexual incestuous relationship with him? You answer this if you can. How well equipped for marriage and a proper relationship with another human being is a little 13-year-old girl who has been forced for 3 years to go to bed for sex with a drunken father? Do you want to know what it's all about? Listen to girl talk during recess or lunch hour in high schools, in which they let each other know the few things you have to do to get favors from dear old dad. How sick is all of this? I heard this from some counselors who are involved in some research that backs up this statement. A single given incident of incest may occur with no one's knowledge except those involved. The practice of incest cannot continue without the knowledge and therefore the sick, tacit consent of the spouse. How well is such a family? I'm not saying this occurs in every alcoholic's family. Please don't mistake me. I'm just saying it's widespread and it's there. I know some women who marry alcoholic after alcoholic. There was a woman down south who married five alcoholics, one after another. They delved into her background, found out she had an incestuous relationship with her father, and my gosh, the explanation is as simple as the sky being blue. She felt so dirty and so guilty, she simply believed that she had no right to happiness. I will not beat this to death. I have mentioned it, now we'll go on. Child abuse. What balance does a child have who is beaten up one day and handed a $20 bill the next? The drinking father who neglects when he's drinking, who feels remorseful when he's sober, and tries to make up for it in giving ways, buying the friendship and love of the child. Wife abuse. How sick can a family get? If I were a woman, I think I would make up my mind before marriage. And I always tell people this before you get married. I know yours is going to be the perfect marriage. We know that. But just in case, have you prepared for anything? What would you do if your husband poked you in the jaw? I know what I'd do. He would poke me once. The second time I'd be gone. What do you think of a woman who puts up with physical beatings almost every week of her life for 16, 18, 22 years? I mean, you know, you're going to have to supply these answers. They're so obvious. Husband abuse just beginning to come to light. When dear old Aggie Amazon beats up on Casper Milk Toast for practice. Only it's not very funny if you're Casper. The emotional devastation. Thin line between love and hate. Ladies and gentlemen, probably the first thing to go is respect. Respect. When respect goes, love usually follows. And when love goes, it's usually replaced by dislike, and sometimes dislike turns into hatred. What are the kids learning? They are made to love. The fish pumps oxygen when it's in water. Take it out. Here is a kid burning for love. He wants to share. This is his whole universe, his mother and his father. He's told to shut up so much at home he becomes a compulsive talker at school or in the houses of other people. Nobody wants him around. Never shuts up. I always tell teachers, look for the serious disciplinary problems in your room. You'll find the bottle at home in about 4 out of 5 cases. I always tell social workers, look for a family not functioning according to income. You'll usually find the bottle in the picture in 4 out of 5 cases. This is all backed up. It's statistical. The emotional devastation of a kid with a near genius IQ who is flunking with the kid who turns to drugs. Do you know how devastating alcoholism is? Ladies and gentlemen, over 50% of recovered alcoholics come from an alcoholic parent. A very interesting statistic I picked up from a doctor friend of mine, he said out of every 15 doctors, 11 have alcohol problems. Most of them had an alcoholic father. I don't know what the significance is. He says it's a simple fact. Some have alcoholic wives, and 3 out of 15 are alcoholics. Every alcoholic who comes from an alcoholic home has said over and over again, it will not happen to me. I won't even touch it. It will not happen to me. I will not get in the shape my father did. I will not be a lush like my mother. What happens, hey, by the way, ladies and gentlemen, unless I spell out a specific case, when I say he as the alcoholic, that's purely grammatical. I mean the alcoholic, either male or female. What happens when roles change? An alcoholic adult is reduced to being an emotional 2-year-old. Very often, a husband will become a parent or a father to the alcoholic wife, and an alcoholic wife will become a mother to the alcoholic husband. And after sobriety enters the lives of the sick alcoholic, they get well and assume an adult role again, the sick non-alcoholic can't cope with that. I know a woman whose husband begged and pleaded with anybody and everybody would listen, help my wife, help my wife, help my wife. After 13 years, she went into a good treatment center and got well. He was so threatened by her sobriety. See, number one, she is his intellectual superior. And when she was drunk and sloshed around, he was not threatened by her. Number two, he has a drinking problem himself. After 2 years, he finally persuaded her to take a drink. Subconsciously, he wanted her back there where she was under him. Thanks be to God, she only drank for a day or two and came running back to AA. Conversely, I know a woman who begged and pleaded for her husband, an alcoholic who used to beat her up. A psychiatrist friend of mine helped that man get sober. On his first anniversary, she gave him a bottle of whiskey. Subconsciously, she wanted him back down there. I know a couple who are quite wealthy. She is an extremely disturbed woman. I truly believe that she would have needed psychiatric care if alcohol had never entered her life. But coupled with her alcoholism, she's a pretty sick lady. Periodically, she gets drunk. She is sent to a very fine rehab center, usually a different one every time. And when she comes out, she's given a reward, a trip, a coat, a gem, a diamond. On the surface, he's rewarding her for getting sober, and I believe in my guts he's rewarding her for getting drunk. When she wants another trip or another coat or another diamond, she gets drunk again, goes through the joke of going into treatment, and comes out and goes away. How many of you in this room have ever said at a meeting, well, thank God my kids were too young to have been affected by my drinking? I mean, my little kid is even too young to go to Alateen. Don't kid yourself, my friends. I would like to point something out. Not to frighten you, not to scare you, but to point out the truth. Your influence on your children begins the day they open the womb. There's a friend of ours who happens to be a lady counselor at a rehab center. She went out with us out west to make this film, and she told me this on the airplane. I put it in the talk, as I'm going to do right now. She said, Father, I honestly believe that my drinking never affected my little girl. She and her husband, who just went through the traumatic experience of a divorce, after her sobriety in AA, they have one child, 22 years old. The tragedy, they do not know whether she is living or dead. She left home at age 14. And this lady said to me, my drinking during those early years was not as bad as it really became. She said, my husband and I could only afford to drink 2 nights a week when she was a baby. But listen to this, my friends. When that little girl went to kindergarten, Mother's Day came around, the teacher said, draw something, take out your pads and crayon, draw something that will please or make your mother happy. Significantly, several of those little kids drew pictures of their dads. You know what this little kid drew? I'm not making this up. She drew a martini glass. That's what makes my mother happy. Well, thank God I got sober, or my drinking didn't really develop until after my kids were grown and married. I know young couples who have divorced because of the alcoholism of a parent. The alcoholism of a mother or father occupies their time, their thought, and their conversation, and their arguments completely. And so many of them break up. Now, ladies and gentlemen, instead of going into a whole lot of little teeny incidents that kids think about and experience and hear and look at and witness, please listen to this. Answer it honestly if you can. Have you ever wished someone dead? I have. And then you nearly kill yourself with the guilt and the remorse for allowing yourself such a thought. Have you ever in your gut, even in your prayers, said, "Dear God, wouldn't it all be better if she were gone? Just gone." There's a company out west whose slogan is, "We care for people." They have an ad that they use on radio and TV. Listen to it and hear what you hear. And this grabs people. They get responses just like that. Is someone you love someone you hate? For a little kid to grow up experiencing feelings like that? I know a mother who looked at her 10-year-old child and asked, "Should I leave your father?" Here's a little teeny kid. His whole world is his mother and his father. Now he's being asked by one of them to make the decision as to whether or not to just shatter his whole world. It's the one of that kid didn't drop dead of a heart attack. And I'm dead serious about that. It's a wonder. The emotional upheaval. The absolute horrible emotional upheaval. Spiritually, many women turn to God and become fanatics because their consciences won't allow them to seek another man. Many of them turn to God and do not get the answers they want and swing away. Of course, the kids inherit either one of those traits. Their spirituality, their sense of religion, their balance in the spiritual life is shattered, if there is any. I always suspect people who have no spiritual guide. Like in AA, I always suspect the AA who has no sponsor. No one is judge in his own case. If we were judges in our own case, we wouldn't need each other. Everyone needs spiritual guidance. I mean, 3 days ago in the airport in Chicago, a young fellow came up to me. I'm dressed this way. He said, "Are you a Christian?" "Well, I have a real PhD here, you know." I said, "Yes." He said, "So am I." I figured I'd say hello. I said, "Fine." And within about 30 seconds, you know, I said, "Where are you going?" He told me. "What do you do?" And I told him. He said, "What do you think of these non-Christian things that try to help people, like AA?" I said, "Son, do you know that AA is completely and totally God-oriented?" "Oh," he says, "is it?" Ignorance is no sin. Advertising it is. But anyway, he and I had a very quiet and extremely brief little talk. And it was sheer ignorance that made him make that mistake. But anyway. The spirituality in an alcoholic family is almost non-existent. Almost non-existent. Going to church, rendering unto God the things that are God's. The emotional illness wrapped up with the spirituality and everything else. Here is a fairly decent wife. My conscience will not allow me to seek elsewhere the affection that I am entitled to get and to give the affection that I'm entitled to give. So many mothers, see if it isn't true in your case, many mothers begin to shower on their children an overabundance of love, and they smother them with motherliness. I remember once approaching a door to a department store with a mother and her 14-year-old son. He approached the door and stood there, and she reached for the handle, and I reached for her wrist. I said, "What are you doing?" She said, "I'm just opening the door." And it hit her like a hammer. She was opening a door for a 14-year-old who should have been opening a door for her. And since then, learning how to pull her hand back when she wants to open doors, she has allowed the boy to grow up, and they enjoy a marvelous relationship. Ladies and gentlemen, these are just a few of the things that can happen in an alcoholic family before treatment, before treatment. And for every incident that I mention, you can mention 20. This talk is not meant to be complete. It's just meant to be a kind of a cross-section. Now, please, help out some problems that arise if the sick alcoholic gets into treatment and he begins to get well, and the non-alcoholic does not get into treatment and stays the same. Dr. Gordon Bell of Canada has made the statement that he simply will not treat an alcoholic unless the family comes into treatment on an outpatient basis at the same time. He says it's futile. Many's a time, see if this has not happened in some of you lady alcoholics. You who have the tougher time, yes, there are differences. I hate this great level of, well, we're all just a bunch of drunks here. No, we're not. There are drunk males and drunk females. There are drunk adults and there are drunk kids. There are drunk whites. There are drunk blacks. And everybody has a different set of circumstances and life and everything else. We are different. That's the one thing we have in common. Anyway, many an alcoholic wife has a horrible time getting sober because of complete lack of cooperation. That's your problem. And let's go back to that couple who the man persuaded his wife to take a drink. That's a horrible relationship. He bitterly resents AA. What the hell do you have to keep going to those meetings for? Well, if he got into treatment, he'd find out. Listen to this one. People can and do abuse AA. I have heard women, people like you, come up to me and say, "Honest to God, Father, I wish he was drunk again. I really do." Why? Well, the kids had no father before because he was drunk. Now they have no father because he's sober. We don't see him. A young friend of mine said, "I truly believe that God gave me my sobriety to fulfill my responsibilities." He said, "Father, I'm married. I have a wife. I'm a father. I have children. I work. I have a boss." Now, he said, "When I fulfill my obligations to my wife, my kids, and my boss, then if I can save a drunk, that's great." And I could have kissed him. I have heard wives say to me in almost a tone of bitterness, "Honest to God, Father, he will go to the gate of hell for a drunken stranger and absolutely refuses to go to a PTA meeting for the good of his child." And yet he's the guy who gets up at an AA meeting and says, "Gee, my kids and I have a lovely relationship now." I'm not knocking, I'm just asking you to listen, please. I heard of a woman who, after several years of sobriety, is still out of the house 7 nights a week. And one night, her 10-year-old came to the bedroom. She was dressing. "Where are you going, Mom?" "To a meeting." He said, "TV dinners again?" And she used the old cop-out. "Would you rather have me as I was?" That little teeny boy, please remember, he must have been 5 or 6 when his mother got sober. He looked his mother right in the face and said, "To tell you the truth, Mom, I'm not too crazy about you either way." He walked out of the room. This is from a child. Balance. My friends, we need guidance to live life. And if we don't get it, we're going to off on some goofy tangent. The non-alcoholic member of an alcoholic family needs treatment whether the alcoholic ever does or not. If you have made up your mind to live with and stay with your alcoholic, you'd better get into help. Get into treatment. Learn how to cope with life through the strength of others. What do I believe is the answer to this thing? It's so simple. Alcoholics help alcoholics. Peer therapy in the phenomenon that we've come to know as Alcoholics Anonymous. Non-alcoholics help non-alcoholics in Al-Anon, either spouse or friend. Children of alcoholics can help children of alcoholics by sharing in Al-Ateen. Ladies and gentlemen, why can't there be such a thing as Al-Family in which an entire family shares the dynamics that goes on with another family that's in pain. Do you know what I believe about human nature? I believe with every fiber of my being that there's a God in his heaven and that he loves us. I also believe that we are intelligent human beings capable of grasping the principles God meant us to live by. You do not need a degree. I believe that illiterate peasants can grasp living as well or better than many so-called educated people. I think that you and I live in an era where we are bogged down with the complete annihilated vocabulary of the various professions. Have you ever noticed every one of us professional people, including clergy, in our insecurity, we jump behind words, especially long words, so that we can dazzle the rest of the world. There was a beautiful young psychologist on the David Hartman show a few months back, and he really did have it all together. He wasn't threatened by anybody. He said, I hope that we reach a degree of growth someday where we can kind of do away with titles and degrees and so on, where there's no such thing as client, patient, counselor, counselee, and so on. You know what I believe about us? I am a strong man. I'm also weak. You are strong. Every one of you in this room has a strength that nobody else has. You're also weak. And that, my friends, is the way God built us, and that is what is behind AA and every other conceivable therapy on earth. Today, my strength supplies for your weakness, and tomorrow, your strength supplies for mine. We are indeed, and this is the big lesson we learn in AA, sweetly dependent on each other. What happens in AA? This island of misery enters a room, and the searchlights of care and giving and loving come and they just bake him with warmth. And he responds, and the disease begins to wane, and the drug goes. He is now alcohol-free. He no longer experiences the desire to drink. He is no longer shackled to self. True sobriety is a reissuing of the gift of love again. He is now free so he can love. Now he's got a searchlight of his own. And in later months, when a new drunk walks in, he gives his name, his phone number, his caring, and his love. He learns to love again, and that warmth has to share itself. And so we begin to share with each other, individuals with individuals. Why can't there be a family in which families share with families? What's happening in your house? The same thing happened in mine. We got through it. How did you get through it? This way, that way, the other way. And we share and we share and we share. And people are freed from those things that shackle them to self, and we breathe the air of freedom again. We are reissued our membership cards to the human race. We have learned to love again. Now we can pass it on to the kids. The kids have been damaged. There's absolutely no doubt of that. Some, I think, will be scarred for life. I also believe that. But I believe, my friends, we can learn to love again. I truly believe this. Parents, having learned to love, can now begin to teach it by living it. If there's anybody in the room with a scientific background, I'm sure you may criticize as overly simplistic what I'm about to say, but I believe there's a great deal of validity to it. It's something that I picked up along the way, and it was backed up just last week. You know Bill Conrad, the fellow that plays Cannon? He narrates a wild animal show, much like Wild Kingdom. Last week it was about a mama mountain lion raising three little baby mountain lions. It was brilliant. But forget the mountain lions, my favorites are the bears. All mama bears raise all baby bears in exactly the same way. And they all crank out mature adult bears. And I don't know why we don't learn from them. I'm dead serious about this. Go into any bear cave and you won't find a copy of Dr. Spock on the library shelf. Or the latest issue of Psychology Today. And I'm not knocking those things. I just believe that the basic principles of living and loving and the ability to teach those things is in us. All it needs is release. A mama bear has two things to teach its young. How to avoid danger to preserve life and how to hunt in order to sustain it. You know how she teaches? Two simple ways. Verbally, she gives signals, and this is the response to them. And then she backs up her verbal teaching through discipline.
The mama bear, like all in the animal kingdom, uses the most important of the five senses, the sense of touch. With her sense of touch, she teaches moist, warm, sweet love. And with the same sense of touch, she teaches some pretty tough, disciplined, hard love. As soon as that baby is born, she licks it clean and washes it, brings it to her side to feed, and in the warmth of her side, that little baby falls asleep completely secure. Now comes the teaching process. When the babies are old enough and they leave the cave, she said, "Now, kids, we have to survive. When you hear this sound, it means danger, and your response is climb up the nearest tree." "Why, Mom?" "Climb the nearest tree." And no explanation. You know what really gets to me is to watch a 31-year-old mother of a 3-year-old child. She holds a master's degree in psychology. She's in a supermarket explaining to a 3-year-old why he shouldn't touch the bottom jar of peanut butter in the display. "Now, honey, that nice man over there spent the last 14 years of his life putting all those things up there, and you wouldn't want to make it." God, then you hear the crash. Blum. Lesson number one, don't touch the peanut butter. What else? She says, "Now, this is the danger signal when you hear it, get up the tree." "What then, Mom?" "Then you wait till you hear this signal, it means it's okay, you can come down from the tree." So she deliberately waits for lesson number one, and she's a little bit patient here. She waits till they're out in the grove somewhere, and she gives the signal for danger, and they're a little reluctant, and she kind of swats them up. Please notice, ladies and gentlemen, when a mama bear swats a baby bear, she does not break the skin and she does not break bones. We do. So she sends them up the tree, and she deliberately lets them get antsy-pantsy, and they want to come down. And she says, "When I tell you to," back up they go. This goes on 6 times. And she has taught them to respond just like that. You don't question, there is no explanation. When I give the signal, you get up that tree. And she practices and practices. And one day they're way out. They're having a marvelous game. Here comes the signal. Now they don't dare gripe out loud because they know they're going to get swatted. So as they're running lickety-split for that tree, little Georgie is saying to Nanette, "It was a dumb signal. We got to go up that stupid tree again." Blah, 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 blah. Up the tree they go. All right, so they're up there, and very quietly he's saying, "That was a pretty good game we had going, and it must have been 600 yards of this dumb tree. Holy smoke, look at that mountain lion." And then they begin to learn that maybe mommies do know something that they don't know. And then they really begin to pay attention because she doesn't give that signal much anymore unless there's real, honest-to-God danger. And then she teaches them to be very patient and to remain immobile when they're hunting, especially a salmon when they come upstream. Be immobile. Be like a rock so there's no movement that'll frighten the fish. And on and on and on. At the end of the learning process, it's all over. And as much as she loves them, they're grown up. In fact, the boy is bigger than she is. She sends them up the tree for the last time. Turns her back and walks away. And I believe that that act, after 2 solid years of almost breathing for her babies, is just about as difficult for a mama bear as it is perhaps for a human mama. But away she goes. She's raised them. She's done her job. And hunger finally brings them down. And as soon as their foot touches ground, they know that this is it. They're independent. They're on their own. And I can see this in later years when they pass dear old mom in the forest. I'm sure they nod their respect, their gratitude, and their reverence to the old girl for preparing them for life. What's your job? Education, my friends, has relatively little to do with the schools you send your youngsters to. Your job is to teach the values, the ideals, and the tools with which they will cope with 2 things, the unpleasantness and the pleasantness of life. Your job is to teach them to cope without chemicals. I think the most horrible thing on TV is not sex or violence, it's the ad for over-the-counter drugs, even in our sleepy little town. Some of us can't get to sleep right away, so we take a drug. We allow our kids to watch this film. And you know what really creams me are these panels in which we discuss. I just came yesterday from someplace in Illinois. We did a little TV thing. They filmed a half-hour TV show. And they were talking about putting on soap, you know, that nighttime successor to Mary Hartman. And there was a lot of pre-showing ballyhoo, and there wasn't anything to the show. And the producer and his wife are in a parish in which a priest got up at Mass and asked the parishioners to sign petitions to have it off the air. So she went up to meet him after Mass. She said, "Father, have you seen it?" He said, "No." Quit blaming TV people for what your kids look at. If you don't want to look at it, turn it off. It's not their business, yours. There are a lot of things on this earth that can be dangerous to us. That's what the mama bear does. She turns off the things that can harm. I believe with a passion that there is hope for any human ailment. I don't care what your family has gone through. It is done. It is done. What you have to do now is cope with those feelings inside. What you have to do now is get rid of hatred, because hatred destroys the hater. And the only way you're going to do this after 18 or 20 years of bitterness and hostility and anger is to reach out your hand to somebody else. Families can help families. Why don't you start some of that here? Why don't you start some of that here? Insurmountable difficulties can be surmounted. I believe that. Do you know why? There's another song in South Pacific, "I'm just a cockeyed optimist," and that's what I am. Ladies and gentlemen, life is too short. There are too many good and beautiful things in this life. You know the principle I function under since I got sober? Margarine covers the bread, but it ain't butter. If you want the best, pay the price tag and you'll get it. If you want the best, pay the price tag and you'll get it. I suppose you noticed tonight a difference. Many of you have done me the kindness over the years of saying that you enjoy the talks I give because of the humor in them. There wasn't anything humorous tonight. I just couldn't think of anything funny. But I'd like to leave you with a smile. There is a difference between pessimism and optimism, and a young psychology professor was teaching it to his class. And when the intellectual lesson was done, he wanted to illustrate it. So he took a very depressed, pessimistic kid, about 12 years old, into a room this big. There was a grocery store, an ice cream parlor, a pastry shop, and a candy store, and a gymnasium full of every conceivable toy under the sun. He said, "Buddy, it's yours." And he locked him in the room for an hour. At the end of the hour, he came back, walked in. The kid is sitting in the middle of the room on a high-backed chair, staring at the floor. None of the stuff was touched. He said, "Don't you like all these goodies?" "Kid says, I love them." He said, "Why didn't you eat anything?" "Well, I know me. I'd have probably eaten too much and gotten sick and thrown up all over the floor." "Well," he said, "how about these toys?" "Oh, yeah." He said, "I like to play." "Why didn't you?" "Well, I'd have probably picked up a toy and busted it and then found out it belonged to somebody else and was the most expensive one in the room. You know, if it's a nice day today, it'll probably rain tomorrow." That was this kid's attitude toward everything. And then he got a hold of a boy in the neighborhood, 12 years old, just a bubbly, happy kid. He used to deliver papers 5 o'clock every morning, and everybody knew where he was and used to whistle. No matter what the weather, he'd whistle. He's just a happy-go-lucky kid. That psychologist took him into, and put him into a room that was full of horse manure, and he locked him in there. At the end of an hour, he came back, and here's this kid with a shovel, and he's shoveling and humming and humming and shoveling and whistling, and he's almost dancing. And the psychologist looked at him and said, "Why so happy?" And the kid looked at him in amazement. He says, "Why so happy? All of this horse manure," he said, "there's got to be a pony in here someplace." "There's got to be." Ladies and gentlemen, too often in AA, we hear a concentration on the suffering that we endured. Forget it. If you really want to get value from meditating on suffering, consider the suffering you caused. The truly honest AA member, male or female, is the one who will allow his spouse to tell his drinking story and then let him tell the rest. Would you dare? The past is valuable only if it contributes to my future. I've heard May say 1,000 times to people who are caught in the throes of remorse and guilt over some things she's done, she said, a mistake is only a mistake if you don't profit from it. In God's holy name, my friends, life is too short. Take the pain and the agony and the bitterness, leave it there, and try to cope with the future. For myself, I hope to God that up until the day I die, I'll be whistling and humming and shoveling, looking for the pony, because I know there's one. And if you've got any sense, you'll be doing the same thing. Thank you and good night.